From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
A reminder that the president's top aide just told the New York Times that the press should keep its mouth shut. No.
That was CNN's Jake Tapper Thursday, referring to comments by presidential aide Steve Bannon in a Times interview. Bannon pointed out that the media got it wrong in their analysis of the presidential campaigns, which he blamed on the media being out of touch with the American people. He recommended as a remedy that the media, quote, keep its mouth shut and just listen for a while, closed quote, provoking an outcry from the press, which characterized it as an attempt at censorship.
We did get a lot of things wrong, and I get what Steve Bannon is saying there, but the notion that we ought to just sit back and not do our job is where I disagree with him.
But is the U.S. corporate media doing its job? That question was looked at in this documentary from RT entitled Failsafe Media, released earlier this week.
We have breaking
Master
news.
Evidence of weapons of mass destruction.
Major combat operation.
The helicopter we were traveling in was forced down after
awful
being hit by an
internet
RPG.
Video.
Thousands of protesters have gathered in Moscow.
Here, no one fakes stories
the
at
Russians
CNN.
Russians were promulgating fake news.
There should be an investigation.
I want to share some information we just learned.
The presidential race is over.
A CNN exclusive.
The Russian hacking
Russian
question.
Russian operatives claim to have compromised.
Vladimir Putin was personally involved in the Russian attempt to disrupt the U.S. election.
It's illegal to possess these stolen documents. It's different for the media. So everything you learn about this, you're learning from us.
You are fake news.
In his first press conference since winning the presidency, Donald Trump slammed a CNN reporter, branding his employer fake news. Barely 24 hours into Trump's presidency, the new White House spokesman, Sean Spicer, viciously attacked many U.S. media outlets.
And while some facts presented by Spicer were questionable, one major issue was swept under the rug by those raging about the first White House briefing, which is what exactly led to this unprecedented attack on the media by the new administration.
If you do the math associated with all the electoral votes from all of the states, if they go that way, if he wins all of the toss-ups, which would be insane because nobody wins all of the toss-up states, he would still lose.
Throughout the U.S. presidential campaign last year, it seemed at times that the mainstream media, which had always declared objectiveness in reporting and denied any claims of bias, did have a preferred candidate after all.
It's not unusual in the U.S. for major outlets to formally endorse one candidate over another during the election season. In 2016, however, the press's enthusiasm for Clinton seemed to warp their perception of reality. On the night before Americans cast their vote, some outlets put Clinton's chances of winning the presidency at between 85% and 98%.
Donald Trump has been saying that he will run for president as a Republican, which is surprising since I just assumed he was running as a joke.
Is that people think that Donald Trump is a clown.
Donald Trump is a clown.
I mean, does anybody seriously think that Donald Trump is serious about running for president?
Donald Trump, you know, he's a clown.
Basically, this is the beginning of the end for Trump.
The beginning of the end.
Beginning of the end?
This is probably starting of the beginning of the end for Donald Trump.
And so, right now, Mr. Trump, to answer your call for political honesty, I just want to say, you're not going to be president, all right?
But the greater irony here is that while the media consistently wrote Trump off, it was largely responsible for his spectacular rise. And that's according to two independent studies of election coverage.
The first, conducted by Harvard Kennedy School, analyzed the tone of coverage relating to both candidates. 77% and 56% negative about Trump during the general election and full campaign, respectively. His opponent got better press during the general election, although the school estimated that when it comes to full campaign, Trump was viewed slightly more favorable by the media.
A second analysis conducted by media watchdog Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting considered 128 stories by major outlets like the New York Times, Washington Post, and USA Today related to the campaign trail. The research spanned only a couple of months leading up to the election, but it demonstrated Trump got twice as much coverage as his opponent at a ratio of 87 to 41.
We now have a chance to talk with the author of that latter study, Benjamin Johnson from Fair. Benjamin, thank you so much for joining us. And my first question to you would be, Can you please tell us how exactly this study was conducted and what actually inspired it?
First, we took the three of the most respected newspapers in the country, and the New York Times, Washington Post, and USA Today, and we looked at August and September in the run-up to the election and all the front-page stories they did. And our goal was to see what kind of stories they were covering, what type of the election, either Senate, House, presidential, or the categories of coverage, like issue coverage, or were they covering a lot of polling data and stuff like that. So the key findings we found were it was very shallow and narrow coverage. The coverage did not focus on the issues much. It made up less than 12%. And the majority of it was campaign strategy pieces that really just focused on the horse race, like who was teetering or who was gaining ground. And a lot of polling coverage too. That made up around 60%, the polling and the campaign coverage, which didn't really tell the voters anything. The majority of the stories that were published on the front page were about Trump. I think about two-thirds of them, and the other third was about Hillary. And that probably did play into Trump having more, notoriety in the press, and voters heard about his name more often. I guess it's kind of understandable because his campaign was much more controversial, but it also lent him a lot of free media time that he would have otherwise not gotten.
And what do you think the impact on focusing on the horse race and the Trump campaign so much had on the election? I mean, the media shapes the way people view the candidates, correct?
Yes. He got tons of free airtime. And on top of that, with most of the coverage not being issue-based, it's not surprising to see that the electorate was very uninformed when it came to major issues before the election. And that could have led to Trump having more success in the election results. But it almost goes back to the old thing that any publicity is good publicity. When everybody hears his name nonstop, that does elevate him.
All right. Benjamin Johnson of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Once Trump was officially declared victorious, some media outlets like the New York Times hung their heads in shame and acknowledged their coverage was wrong. Others remained defiant, almost openly declared war on the president-elect, and laid blame on others, including this network.
Amid the heat of the election campaign, political writer Michael Crowley pointed the finger at RT, suggesting that we as a network have chosen our candidate in the U.S. election, and it was Trump. That's despite the then Republican candidate appeared on our network only once for a phone chat with his old friend Larry King. We never streamed any of the Trump speeches live. He recorded numerous exclusive interviews with one of the Democratic hopefuls for candidacy, Bernie Sanders, when he was almost deprived of airtime on mainstream media. Our network has never officially endorsed any of the candidates, unlike Politico.
We extended an invitation to Crowley last week to discuss the allegations he made about this network on our show. He did not respond. But instead, we want to turn to legal and media analyst Lionel from Lionel Media. Welcome to the show, Lionel. What was your reaction to Politico's allegations that RT was a pro-Trump network?
The reaction was that I was waiting to see the case made. I'm a lawyer by profession, and I have this thing called proof, and I understand that if an accusation is made, there should be some type of a connector, the accusation to the proof, and nothing was there. If this was an indictment, it would be dismissed for lack of basically pleading a case. And to say that it was breathtakingly incoherent would be to be complimentary.
You would expect, after all these apologies from the New York Times and others, that people would, you know, have a wake-up call and stop doing fake news, in fact. But even in the last weekend, we've seen a spectacular conversation between CNN Twitter and Nancy Sinatra, where she basically bashed CNN and called them liars. So why are they keep doing this? Why do they keep embarrassing themselves even further?
Okay, first of all, number of reasons. Number one, they're not embarrassing themselves because nobody cares. Because the average mainstream media consumer doesn't care. Number two, the consumer is so used to this, so habituated to this. Fake news, fake news, fake news, retractions, this is wrong, this is wrong. It doesn't mean anything anymore. Number three, they don't expect anything from the mainstream media. And there is no repercussion. And that's the biggest part. Nobody is called out. Nobody is blamed. Nobody's fired. There's no sense of journalism integrity. See, people are just being hit with this news over and over and over in the form of headlines and Facebook and Twitter. So they're overwhelmed by this. They just want it to stop. So which fake news are you talking about? Which of the thousands of pellets of buckshot are you talking about? People are tired of it, and they become used to it, sad to say.
We have breaking news. The Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad did in fact use chemical weapons to kill more than 1,000 people outside Damascus on August 21st.
Another issue where media coverage was often very questionable is the Syria conflict, particularly when eastern Aleppo was reclaimed by the Assad's troops. Just this week, one of the anti-Assad activists who was among the people fronted by the mainstream media as a citizen of Aleppo fleeing the genocide wrote a piece for the New York Times in which she suggested that the population of eastern Aleppo had shrunk to 50,000 people by November. That's five times less than the much-publicized white helmets reported on, guess what, back in November.
The activist also talked about accusations she made regarding attacks made on convoys trying to leave Aleppo as more like rumors when she previously tweeted them as fact. At the time, her tweets from the ground in Aleppo went viral, and she was featured as a guest on several mainstream television outlets.
The American media has done everything in its power to discredit the role of Russia in the Syrian conflict, mainly by stressing that Moscow has backed Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad and ignoring facts that terrorists with al-Qaeda's Nusra Front had infiltrated the Free Syrian Army. So when Russia carried out airstrikes against these groups in 2015, the media covered the events like this.
It does appear that they were in areas where there probably were not ISIL forces, and that is precisely one of the problems with this whole approach.
Meanwhile, the United States government had been arming the rebels, and there was no way of knowing whether any could be considered moderate as claimed. But instead of going hard on these facts, the media played on public sympathy.
In 5 years of war, more than 250,000 people have lost their lives. That includes 4,500 children in Aleppo alone. Millions more displaced, without a home. Now that includes Omran. And what strikes me is we shed tears, but there are no tears here. He doesn't cry once. That little boy is in total shock.
But when it came to the deaths of these children, the mainstream media was silent.
Rebel shells have kept falling on Western Aleppo. One found its way into a packed street in the Al-Jamaliyah neighborhood. The aftermath you can see behind me. Three people now confirmed dead. A number of children, a number of adults injured as well. Distraught, grieving, and angry relatives packed the hallways.
And when eastern Aleppo was on the brink of being reclaimed by government forces, the U.S. media went into full-on meltdown mode.
There are a lot of people in the human rights community and people who are looking at what has essentially been a genocide by another name.
All of that was largely based on social media reports by people mainstream media described as citizens of Aleppo. However, doubts have been raised over the legitimacy of such reports, and evidence shows that some of these citizens are on the payroll of anti-Assad organizations. One person who shared final messages from Aleppo on social media was Bilal Abdul Karim, an independent American journalist. Here he is in a video standing side by side with a man wearing an explosive belt. And with so many journalists being killed for exposing crimes carried out by terrorists, Karim's reporting raises many questions. Still, he has produced a series for CNN and has also appeared on the network, fueling concerns about what kind of people mainstream media is giving publicity to.
Murad Gazdiev was among the very few actually in Aleppo during those events. Murad, you had been to Aleppo a lot of times. You covered the war out of Syria when very few of our mainstream media colleagues from the West were actually there. Did you see anybody from the mainstream media? And if not, why do you think they refused to go there?
Well, there were in Aleppo specifically, though I've been to many parts of Syria, and in almost all of them I've seen Western journalists. But in Aleppo itself, of course, there was a rush of people trying to get there. Unfortunately, many of them couldn't. First of all, because the Syrian government is, it's very wary of these people, of many journalists, especially from the mainstream media, because they come into Syria, they go to all these places where the Syrian government provides them with security, provides them with access, they go there and then they say what an evil dictator Assad is, and there isn't a second side to it, so they go on Assad's invitation to all these places and say what a bad man he is, and then they leave. Obviously, that's completely ruined their relationship with the Syrian government. Interestingly enough, they never tried to go in on the side that they're supporting, on the rebel side. It's only a number, several handful of journalists that have dared to go in from the rebel half or into the rebel part of Syria, because obviously everybody's scared of being kidnapped, of being beheaded by religious extremists. So there is that as well. They want to go to Syria, they can't go in on the side that they support because it's too dangerous, and they can't go in on Assad's side because, well, obviously Assad doesn't like them anymore because of editorial stance, editorial position. Nevertheless, there are groups that come in, BBC, Washington Post, New York Times, I've seen them all come into Syria, be allowed access to film in Aleppo and in other places.
Murad, there's also been a lack of acknowledgement among many Western journalists or discussion of who the opposition or the rebels are. For example, you were the only journalist to report and the first journalist to report the fact that the ISIS flag, black ISIS flag, for example, was flying in East Aleppo. Why do you think there's a blackout when it comes to who the rebels are and even their ties to Al-Qaeda and an unbalanced coverage in terms of the suffering that you witnessed, for example, in Western Aleppo?
Well, look at it this way. So these journalists come into Aleppo, they film whatever they want, they film, they have access to pretty much the whole city, and they pump out an almost exclusively anti-Assad, pro-rebel rhetoric. For example, all these journalists, Western journalists for big companies that came into Aleppo while I was there, there was a month where there were no Russian airstrikes, no Syrian government airstrikes on Eastern Aleppo, on the besieged part of Eastern Aleppo. None of them said so. None of them said that, the Russians and the Syrians aren't bombing. They came in, all these people in eastern Aleppo, in the rebel-held part of Aleppo, they weren't allowed to leave. The rebels wouldn't let them leave. They were essentially human shields. It took more than a month of reporting, our reporting, other channels, before they did acknowledge eventually that, maybe these people aren't being allowed out. And this is despite the fact that, CNN and other news outlets, they regularly feature people that they say are inside Eastern Aleppo. So, how can they be so clueless about what's happening there? They aren't. Let's be real. They know exactly what's happening there. They only tell part of the truth. I won't say, that they're lying about what's happening in Syria, but telling half the truth is in my book, pretty much the same thing.
We also spoke to terrorism theorist and international relations professor Max Abrams from Northeastern University about the Syria coverage.
For several years now, we've had a very one-sided narrative on Syria. And it has been the pro-regime change narrative in Washington, D.C., among the think tank pundits, the self-described Syria experts. There's a widespread view. In fact, it's definitely the majority view. They say absolutely anything in order to strengthen the case for removing President Assad. It is impossible to separate the media and think tanks in the United States when it comes to the analysis of foreign affairs. And so this is why there's been so much fake news in the United States, because the journalists, they basically defer to the think tanks. When there's an interview to be made about Syria, they'll call up these think tank pundits, perhaps unaware that they're being funded by the same sources as the rebels themselves, and also unaware that the track record of these pundits for getting the basic facts of Syria right has been abysmal.
Well, let me say a few facts so that I know. The Russians hacked the Democratic National Committee. There is no question about that. My source is not the Intelligence Committee. They have hacked. That's a fact.
Our final example of misreporting in the mainstream is the frenzy which ensued after anonymous intelligence officials made allegations Russia meddled in last year's presidential election and has embarked on a sinister campaign to undermine American democracy.
Wording has been different in those reportings, but there was one constant almost everywhere. Unnamed sources. Washington Post cited unnamed sources. New York Times, CNN, almost every media outlet did its stories based on information acquired from nobody knows where. This tendency reached its explosive culmination with the infamous Trump dossier, which created an unprecedented situation at Trump's first press conference since the election win.
As far as BuzzFeed, which is a failing pile of garbage, writing it, I think they're going to suffer the consequences. They already are.
Chance, your organization you are attacking our news organization. Can you give us a chance to ask a question, sir?
Go ahead.
Sir, Mr. President-elect, can you state categorically, Mr. President-elect, can you give us a question? You're attacking us. Can you give us a question? Can you give us a question?
I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you state categorically?
You are fake news.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh, one of the biggest names in domestic investigative journalism of the last several decades, recently joined a growing list of independent journalists criticizing the mainstream media's spin on the alleged Russian hacking.
Here's what he told The Intercept last week.
My view of the way the major media treated the Russian thing and the Putin wiretap and the hacking is they were hectoring. And the real story was the extent to which the White House was going and permitting this kind of stuff to go and permitting the agency to go public with assessments that there were assessments. What does an assessment mean? It's not a national intelligence estimate. If you had a real estimate, you would have had five or six dissents, people saying, because I can tell you right now, at one time they said 17 agencies all agreed. Oh, really? The Coast Guard and the Air Force, they all agreed on that? You know, it was outrageous.
As a result of rushed, unconfirmed reporting, prominent media outlets reverted to uncomfortable backpedaling, namely the Washington Post. First, it was forced to make an editor's note on a story which accused alternative media sources of peddling fake news on behalf of the Russian government. The note admitted the Post could not, quote, vouch for the validity of the source their blacklist was based on, though it refused to issue a retraction. But nothing topped their story declaring Russia hacked an electric grid in Vermont. The story was completely false, as clarified by an editor's note at the top of the page. However, the story remains on the site without a complete retraction. The Post editor also recently had to publicly apologize on Twitter to this network after claiming RT never responded to the newspaper's questions for an article while publishing RT's responses in that very article.
But the bizarre part is that the very same newspaper, amid its never-ending flow of retractions of fake news, published a survey called Americans, especially but not exclusively Trump supporters, believe crazy, wrong things, in which they showed that while a large part of polled Trump supporters believed the so-called Pizzagate story was true, 80% of them do not believe Russia had anything to do with Trump's win. And spectacularly, half of Clinton's supporters actually believed Russians somehow tampered with the vote tallies. That's despite bipartisan reassurances that this never took place.
We want to bring in Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media studies at New York University. Professor, we're living in an era where the media is publishing unconfirmed reports based on anonymous sources, and the Trump administration, is delivering press conferences based on alternative facts. You've studied the media for years. Is this post-truth era something that surprises you?
There's no question but that Trump and his team routinely lie, sometimes crudely, usually in a way that's easy to refute, and often on fairly trivial matters. They lie often wildly, and it's important to note they lie without any finesse. That's regrettable, but it's not anywhere near as troubling as the additional fact that on their part, the corporate press, much of the left press, the CIA, and both the parties also lie, but they lie with far more suavity. They lie much more in a much more polished way. And they tell lies that appear to be true to many people because they're based on a whole lot of prior lies. So when people hear, for example, that Russia hacked the power grid in Vermont, when they hear about this dossier of incriminating evidence supposedly gathered by the Kremlin on Donald Trump, they will believe these claims because they've already come to believe that Russia hacked the DNC. Well, there's no evidence for any of this. It's all fake news. I've seen a lot of corporate propaganda, a lot of state propaganda in my time, but I've never seen anything like this. There's a real crisis of credibility. The whole system is pretty much impossible to believe right now, and people are understandably very troubled and disoriented by it.
Professor, speaking of which, the recent Gallup poll of 2016 put the trust in media in the United States at almost the all-time low of 32%. I mean, if it's a disease, there should be some kind of cure. What do you think the media executives, the corporate media or left media or right media, doesn't matter, should do now to win back the trust so that the fourth estate reverts back to being fourth estate, not the failed estate?
Our news business is largely dominated by a handful of enormous multinational media corporations. They have certain commercial imperatives driving what they do. And secondly, and this is related to the first problem, we have a news business that's been heavily compromised by American intelligence agencies, which are agencies that basically deceive and disinform for a living, have a certain vested interest in promoting a certain line on various stories, a certain vested interest on ensuring that certain stories don't get told at all. So if we're going to get back to the spirit of the First Amendment and realize the dream of a genuinely varied, honest press that serves the interest of the public, we have to engage in some really radical rethinking of what our news business should look like. We're going to have to think very seriously about that and no doubt bring about something like a revolution to make it happen.
Let's be optimistic this may come into fruition someday. Professor Mark Crispin-Miller from New York University, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate your input.
Thank you.
Over the last several months, our network has been the subject of increased attacks by our colleagues in the mainstream media. Not only, but a whole third of intelligence report was about us, also operating on data from 3-4 years ago.
We were accused by the Office of the Director for National Intelligence of influencing citizens and undermining American democracy, a threat we pulled off, according to the intelligence agencies, by reporting on Occupy Wall Street, third-party candidates and their views, health concerns posed by fracking, and basically other issues the mainstream media were reluctant to cover. Yet at the same time, outlets which reported our immense threat downplayed our role by comparing social media followers.
And when you thought things could not get more confusing, came the review of Trump's inauguration coverage by the New York Times, which had several major U.S. news organizations and RT. Not only were we the only foreign network to get the nod from the Times, but also called our coverage balanced. Thank you, New York Times.
The purpose of our program was not to throw punches, but to analyze what our friends in the mainstream can do to win back the trust of its audience. We invited several mainstream media frontmen to come on this show, but never got a response.
As one of the founding fathers of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, said, honesty is the first chapter in the book of wisdom. Whether you tune into CNN or MSNBC or Fox to get news and opinions, or prefer this network, or all of the above, you and only you can decide what's fake and what's not.
And never forget to question more.
We have breaking
massive
news.
Evidence of weapons of mass destruction.
Major combat operation.
The helicopter we were traveling in was forced down after
awful
being hit by an
internet
RPG.
Video.
Thousands of protesters have gathered in Moscow.
There no one fake stories
the
at
Russians
CNN.
Russians were promulgating fake news.
There should be an investigation.
I want to share some information we just learned.
The presidential race is over.
A CNN exclusive.
The Russian hacking
Russian
question.
Russian operatives claim to have compromising
Everything
information.
You learn about this, you're learning from.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.